Today on the 21st, an interview with Illinois Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton on protests, policing, and what it will take to rebuild trust with Black communities.
You know, when you have a healthy community, you don't see police in that same way. What makes that community healthy that they don't have to rely on police so much or have so many police in their neighborhoods?
Plus, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled a landmark civil rights law protects the LGBTQ community from discrimination at work. We'll ask a constitutional lawyer how the ruling might affect people here in Illinois. Then, University of Illinois head football coach Lovie Smith has built the most racially diverse coaching staff in the country. We'll talk to a sports writer who thinks it can serve as a model for other programs. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up on The 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. The news is next. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. In the weeks since George Floyd was killed under the knee of a Minneapolis police officer, protests, mostly peaceful, have continued across America and across Illinois. Some of those events have featured Illinois' top political leaders, including Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, who's my first guest today. I spoke with Stratton Tuesday afternoon over Zoom. Our conversation touched on calls to defund the police, the power of police unions, and later on, the status of some of the investment in Black and brown communities that's supposed to flow from the legalization of marijuana. As ever, we'd love to hear what you thought about today's program. Send us an email at talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Lieutenant Governor Stratton, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to begin by asking about the protests that have been taking place, not just all over the country, but across Illinois. And I want to begin by asking, how would you rate the quality of the job the police have done in handling these protests that we've seen?
Well, I would say first and foremost, these protests have been unprecedented in many ways, including what we have seen here in the state of Illinois. Not only have there been protests in every state in the nation and protests globally, but we've seen protests in many rural communities throughout the state. And I would say that by and large, we have had peaceful protests where people are raising their voices, that they are proclaiming that Black Lives Matter, and they are calling for police accountability. Having said that, we know that there have also been cases and incidents that we have seen over the last several weeks of protest that not only have been where many would describe examples of excessive use of force or at least over-policing, but we also, of course, have seen additional people, whether it's in the context of protest or outside of a context of protest, mostly. We've continued to see unarmed Black men and women being killed. When we think about what happened with George Floyd and his murder and the knee that was on his neck by Officer Chauvin that really sparked so much of what we see, those 8 minutes and 46 seconds that his knee was on his neck, squeezing the life out of him, out of George Floyd. We also know that there have been so many other names of people, including Breonna Taylor and the incident that happened with Ahmaud Arbery. And I think that what people are saying all across our nation and of course across the state of Illinois is that we cannot continue to see police brutality happen as it has, and we cannot continue to see a lack of accountability for police when these types of killings take place.
One of the rallying cries we've heard out of these Black Lives Matter protests is this idea of defunding the police. I wonder, do you support the idea of defunding the police?
Well, Governor Pritzker and I just recently on June 9th, the day that George Floyd was laid to rest, we issued a joint proclamation to honor Mr. Floyd and other unarmed victims of police brutality. And our proclamation made it very clear that Black lives matter in the state of Illinois. And we know that Black people have traditionally been over-policed. There cannot be a system that protects officers who do not serve and protect, who kill with impunity. And, you know, I named some of those names, whether it's George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, or many others. We have heard that cry be loud and clear. You know, I think that this concept is really a question for local leaders and at municipal and county levels, but this is not the first time that we've heard this phrase, defund the police. We heard those same cries in Chicago after the death of Laquan McDonald by Chicago police officer. And those cries have continued. So it's not new to this particular moment in time. At the very core, I would say, is a call for a shift in our financial priorities and communities holding us accountable about what we choose to invest in. And quite frankly, I think that's always at the core of social justice movements.
I wonder if you think the slogan, though, in particular, is that something that is a political liability for Democrats, or is it a way to help expand the idea of what's possible? Because I think, as you know, when you get down to it, people are not saying have no police, although I suppose some people are, but they're saying, you know, take the money so police are not doing, you know, necessarily responding to the wide variety of things we ask them to do now, and instead have some sort of unarmed people, maybe schooled in conflict mediation or something like that. I wonder what you think about that idea that, you know, it's a term that's going to scare some voters away, but it also helps expand the idea of what's possible. Where do you come down on that divide?
Well, I think first and foremost, people are talking about it. People are talking about the financial priorities and how we, at different levels of government, what we choose to invest in and what that looks like. And that's a conversation that's being had right now. I know as far as, you know, as, again, thinking about this being more from a local or county level, I think at the state level, we are having continued conversations with the Black Caucus. We participated in 4 days of action that have been organized by the statewide Joint Black Caucus to really think about how we create a justice system that better reflects our values. And so what Governor Pritzker and I, the conversations that we've been having, not only with the Black Caucus, but with other leaders and those who are lifting their voices during this time, is about what needs to happen and what can we do at the state level all across the board from a criminal justice reform standpoint. I think from, you know, one of the things that I've considered is, as I said before, this is not a new term. And, I certainly, you know, won't be in a position at this particular moment to kind of, say what language anyone should be using. What I will say is that we have to make sure that there's real action. And I think that's what people are crying for, that they're saying that, you know, we have seen unarmed Black men and women be killed with impunity, where there's been no accountability. And we know that communities, Black communities in particular, have felt over-policed. And so when people are saying what we want to see is investment in our communities and some real bold investments being made in our communities, when we hear people saying, you know, what are we doing to make sure that there are investments in mental health services and bringing up issues such as food justice and access to healthcare and all of these other things that make a healthy community, that what's really happening right now is those conversations are happening. And that's a good thing.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, the Lieutenant Governor of Illinois. You've mentioned a couple of times now this idea of over-policing in Black and brown communities in Chicago. And that is certainly something we hear a lot about. But there are also people who talk about those communities being under-policed in a different way in terms of the too low clearance rate for solving murders in those communities. And too much of a focus on, you know, so-called broken windows or quality of life crimes, and not enough of a focus on the really serious crimes. I wonder what you make of that contention.
Well, I've always thought, and I don't know if those are still tactics that we see being used in Illinois, but I remember when the talk was very popular to talk about this sort of broken windows approach to policing, I remember thinking about how decades of disinvestment in Black and brown communities across our city and state, the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois. I remember thinking how there weren't a lot of windows to break because there weren't as many businesses and small businesses and other kinds of places that could be broken. And that's a testament to the kind of disinvestment that has happened in these communities for so long. I think that we know that there's many people, when we think about the lack of trust that communities of color often have, and Black communities in particular often have with the police system. I think it's from two ways. It's one, looking at the sort of history of going back to thinking of even how policing kind of evolved from its roots, even dating back to slavery, and thinking about this method of sort of controlling communities. And that conversation about sort of the history has kind of always led to this sort of tenuous relationship over time. At the same time, we know that every community wants to live in a safe community. Every person wants to live in a safe community. There's no one that I could ask in the state of Illinois, is there anybody who does not want to live in a safe community? Is there anyone who wants to live in a community where your children cannot be free to go out and play in the streets and enjoy games like all other children? Or is there anybody who does not want to be able to walk through their community and feel free from crime? Of course there is. But what I think that this conversation that's happening right now brings up is that in many of these same communities, we also see higher rates of violence and other issues that are sort of reflective of the community's health and it not being healthy. And so if having so many police in the community has not address this issue, have not made these communities safer, then what else can happen? What are the other things that need to happen in the community to make sure that the community is built back up, that the community has access to the resources that it needs, that the community has a grocery store and restaurants and small businesses that are starting and growing and expanding? How do we make sure that these communities have access to healthcare resources, especially in this age of COVID-19, mental health resources. So the conversation has to be much more comprehensive about what safety means and how communities feel safe. And it also has to come back to the question of contact with law enforcement. So when you talk about, for example, being able to solve crimes and to make sure that when violence does happen, that we understand, you know, that there's an identity of who committed that act and how there is accountability from that standpoint. You know, when those kinds of crimes go unsolved and people don't feel that these issues are taken, you know, into account in their communities, then people start to feel that there's really not a whole lot of trust that they have in the system as a whole to protect them. And that's also an issue. So people don't want to have that daily contact when I talk about over-policing. It's the same issue that we see in schools when people talk about why do we have so many police in our school systems, to really think about like what's needed. You know, when you have a healthy community, by the way, you don't see police in that same way. What makes that community healthy that they don't have to rely on police so much or have so many police in their neighborhoods? Those are the same things I think we hear communities, Black communities across our state saying they want for their own communities.
I think I've heard people make that very point in a slightly different way, which is that many parts of the country have already basically abolished policing, and those are largely white neighborhoods where they don't have that daily contact that you're referring to.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, I know you're a state official, but I do want to ask about the Chicago Police Department. You represented Chicago in the Illinois House of Representatives, if I'm not mistaken, before you were lieutenant governor. And the Chicago police, you mentioned the Laquan McDonald shooting. You know, they have this history of shooting unarmed or barely armed people. I was thinking of Betty Jones, a woman who was shot accidentally while they were aiming for someone else. And there's also this legacy of torturing false confessions out of Black men. Do you think the department can be reformed, or should Chicago and other cities follow the lead of what some in Minneapolis are trying to do, which is end the current police department and start fresh with some new concept?
Well, I know that the city of Chicago officials will continue to are having these conversations. Clearly, these are conversations that are ongoing. The mayor and the city council will continue to address those issues. And I really don't want to delve into what a particular municipality should or should not do specifically. What I will say is that, we across in communities across the state and across the country have to continue having not just conversations about what has happened and the real trauma in many ways that has continued in communities across Black communities across the country as it relates to the relationship with police. When you have people being killed, unarmed people being killed. So I think it's a situation where at every level of government, we have to have these conversations and not just look at it from a standpoint of policing, but look at it in the context of the entire criminal justice system. And that is what happens of how people enter the system. We know that the criminal justice system is disproportionately Black and brown, both from the point of arrest to incarceration, from detention and jails to who's in our prisons. And so, and the difficulties that remain, by the way, after people exit our system, trying to reenter their communities, and the barriers that are placed in getting jobs and housing and healthcare and education. So it's, I think at every level, at least in my position, and as Governor Pritzker and I think about these issues from a statewide level, it's important for us to recognize what can we do at a state level. And what do we need to do to think about this system from beginning to end? And that's going to require working with our municipal leaders as well. But we can't just focus on one area. We have to think about why are so many from the Black community entering the system in the first place? And what role does policing, which is the entry point of that, what role does policing play? And then what happens because 95% of people do come home from the Illinois Department of Corrections? And what happens when they come back to our communities? Are our communities suited for them to continue to be productive and have chance for opportunity and real equity? Or is it a system that they cycle in and out of? And we know what the history has been, of course. We're trying to change that by looking at what we can do at every level of government.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. We need to take a short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. My guest today is Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton of Illinois. Before the break, we were talking about the protests that have erupted across the country and across Illinois, big cities, small towns, after the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, the police killings, as well as Ahmaud Arbery and other tragedies that have happened recently. And before the break, we were talking specifically about the Chicago Police Department. I want to take sort of a broader statewide view. You know, it strikes me that in Illinois, the previous governor, Bruce Rauner, spent 4 years trying to convince Democrats that government employee unions had too much power, public employee unions. And Democrats fought back hard. But now they seem to be open to the idea that police unions, at least, have too much power. I wonder, do you think that changing the power of police unions needs to be part of what's done in Illinois to fix what's broken about the systemic racism in the way Black and brown communities are policed?
I mean, I think that, you know, certainly one of the questions that's come up is the issue of what's happening with qualified immunity and any efforts to keep people from being held accountable. You know, the calls that we are hearing across this nation for police accountability means just that, that people should not be able to kill with impunity, whether you carry a badge or not. You should be held responsible. And I think any efforts to try to keep people from being held responsible are always going to be a barrier for us to make real progress. And right now, when you have the whole world calling for progress, I think it's certainly a time that we have to look at every option to figure out how do we make sure that this does not happen again. And we're hoping, although we've heard a lot of rhetoric from certain individuals from, you know, the FOP and others that may not see this as something that needs to be negotiated or talked about, But I think that this is an area that there certainly has to be conversation if there's going to be anything that changes.
A little more than a week ago, you and Governor Pritzker and other political and community leaders held a march and rally in Madison in the south suburbs. And there have been other similar events and marches. Republicans have pointed to that and said it's hypocritical from an administration that is still prohibiting gatherings of more than 10 people. And now they filed a lawsuit seeking to be exempt from the state's ban on larger gatherings. I wonder, how do you respond to that?
Well, look, we have been gathering because we have seen a movement around the globe where people are coming together right now in this moment in time to say no more. We are not going to stand idly by while another unarmed Black man like George Floyd or another unarmed Black woman like Breonna Taylor, who was in her home sleeping when the police entered her her home and she was shot to death. This is a moment in time where I would hope that others would join this call and to say that police must be held accountable in these circumstances and that Black lives do matter and that we have to make sure that we address these issues. So the governor and I have made that clear. We have stood with those who are peacefully protesting, who are marching, not just in the city of Chicago, but in communities all across the state of Illinois, like Taylorville and Anna, Illinois, and Carbondale, Illinois, and everywhere in between, to say at this moment in time, this is one of the most critical issues of our day. And I think that it's an important message. It's important that the leadership of this state makes it clear. And I urge leaders all across the state to make it clear that we must have police accountability and real reform of our criminal justice system.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. And just in the few minutes we have remaining, I want to shift gears a little bit. We're 6 months into the legalization and commercialization of marijuana in Illinois. And a big part of that effort, I know an issue that's near and dear to your heart, is the R3 program. It stands for Restore, Reinvest, and Renew. Can you remind our listeners what that is and how is that effort going now that we are 6 months into this program?
Sure. So I chair the Restore, Reinvest, and Renew Board, which fortunately we get to call the R3 Board, which is a little less of a tongue twister. And the focus of the R3 program is to reinvest 25% of the net cannabis tax revenues into those same communities that were most harmed by the war on drugs. There is a current notice of funding opportunity, which is on the street now. We have made sure that equity, our R3 board has made sure that equity is sort of centered in this funding opportunity, where there's an opportunity for planning grants and other community grants in five particular service areas, which include civil legal aid, reentry services, violence prevention, youth development, and economic development. And so during this first application cycle, there's $31.5 million of grant funds that are going to be available for community-based organizations. We're providing technical assistance through the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority to make sure that organizations across our state will have the information they need to put forth a strong proposal. And the areas have been identified all across the state using various census tracts. And just for your listeners, the grant applications are due on July 20th, and they can get more information at r3.illinois.gov.
And I just want to ask before we say goodbye about one other restorative aspect of that legislation, which was the idea that it would allow people to try to expunge past marijuana convictions. And I know there was a flurry of activity on this around the new year, but I wonder, is it happening as quickly as it should, or is this something else that's on hold because of the pandemic?
Well, as you know, with the COVID-19 pandemic and the resulting stay-at-home order, which certainly was needed and has helped us to make the progress that we have here in Illinois, where we have flattened the curve and are starting to reopen the state in phases. But one of the results of that was that court systems throughout the state also had to reduce operations and sometimes stop operations. So there's still a priority to make sure that people are aware that they can pursue getting their records expunged for cannabis-related offenses, low-level cannabis-related offenses. And you know, as things begin to open up, I'm sure that there will be more of a push to make sure that cases move through the system. But like everything else, you know, we have to recognize and be patient and recognize that this was not expected, that we would be in the midst of a global pandemic. And the most important thing, first and foremost, was to make sure we saved as many lives as possible. And so court systems will begin to open back up. Processing of these cases will continue to move forward. But during the last few months, we had to focus on the top priority, and that was the public health pandemic that we were facing.
Juliana Stratton is the Lieutenant Governor of Illinois. Lieutenant Governor Stratton, thank you for taking the time to speak with us on the 21st.
Thanks so much, and thanks for having me, Brian.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that a landmark civil rights law protects lesbian, gay, and transgender employees from discrimination based on sex. An estimated 8.1 million such workers across the country previously had no protection against workplace discrimination from their state governments. But here in Illinois, LGBTQ workers were already protected under 2006 amendments to the state's Human Rights Act. But the ruling will allow workers to file claims with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and pursue their cases in federal court. For more on this, Camilla Taylor joins us now. She's the Director of Constitutional Litigation for Lambda Legal, a nonprofit that focuses on LGBTQ litigation. Camilla Taylor, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And if you or someone you know might be affected by this ruling or you have a question about it, you can join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. The phone lines are open at 800-222-9455. So, Camilla, can you briefly remind us what the Supreme Court was considering in this ruling and what they decided?
Yes, we are thrilled because the Supreme Court was considering the meaning of the word sex in the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964 that you described. And this Civil Rights Act prohibits discrimination in the workplace. And the question the court had to consider is whether discrimination based on a person's sexual orientation or on a person's gender identity or transgender status was a form of discrimination based on sex. Because if it is, then that means that it is prohibited by this federal law that was passed in 1964. And the Supreme Court did agree with the employees that discriminating against someone because they're transgender or because they are gay, lesbian, or bisexual is a form of sex discrimination. And this means that now LGBT employees around the country enjoy protection that many of them lacked before. And as you mentioned, Illinois is one of a minority of states that explicitly prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity under state law. But most states, like Indiana and Missouri, do not.
So let's talk. Yeah. So I want to come back to the as I think there's an interesting the way the ruling came down and who was voting in the majority is interesting. But I want to come back to that. Let's focus on Illinois. As you mentioned just a moment ago, and as I said earlier, members of the LGBTQ community here in Illinois were already protected under state law. But how does this ruling change things for those workers here in Illinois?
Well, as you mentioned, you can now go to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and you can file a charge. And that is an important benefit. You can go to federal court. But it's also important to recognize that this law will have a sweeping impact on other federal laws that prohibit sex discrimination. Right now, there are laws that prohibit sex discrimination in educational settings and in housing and in healthcare settings as well. And courts usually look to Title VII when trying to figure out how to interpret those laws. So it's fair to assume that courts will now conclude that those existing federal laws also prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity in those other contexts, which means that seniors will enjoy protection in nursing homes from being harassed by other residents that they may not have enjoyed before. And transgender people who experience discrimination in healthcare settings, who have doctors turn them away, will enjoy firm protection that may not have been as explicitly acknowledged by courts before. So this is very exciting. And it's also a rebuke of the Trump administration, which recently had passed a series of regulations now targeting lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in a variety of different contexts by trying to narrow interpretations of sex discrimination precedents to exclude them. So there are many ways in which Illinois residents will enjoy protection as a result of this ruling, even outside the context of employment.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. My guest is Camilla Taylor. She's Director of Constitutional Litigation for Lambda Legal. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court ruling earlier this week that protects LGBTQ workers from discrimination in employment. If you want to join the conversation, our number is 800-222-9455. So, Camilla, you mentioned the Trump administration, and the court's decision is a direct rebuke to the position that the administration had taken, siding with employers in these cases. And Justice Neil Gorsuch, who was a Trump appointee and is widely regarded as a conservative jurist, he wrote the majority opinion. Do you think that this decision could be a glimpse into future rulings from what has been regarded as a conservative court, at least on these sort of issues?
Well, this was a simple question of statutory interpretation. It was a question that asked the court whether the court should interpret the words of the law as it is written, or whether the court should look outside the law and consider what might have been in the heads of the legislators in 1964 when they were passing the law. And very conservative justices like the late Justice Scalia were pioneers of a doctrine called textualism, which means you don't look outside the four corners of the statute unless the language of the statute is confusing. And the decision by Justice Gorsuch in this case relied heavily on past precedents, including by Justice Scalia, that are inherently very conservative in nature. He concluded that the law is clear on its face, and it would be inappropriate to try to import extra textual information or evidence to try to get into the heads of the legislators at the time, because that would be using imagination instead of doing what the statute required. And if the law is clear, you have to follow it.
And I guess the argument from the other side would be that maybe LGBT people wouldn't have been top of mind in the drafters of this legislation in the mid-1960s, but the textualist argument is, doesn't matter if the language is plain. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. There are all sorts of laws that are plainly written that might have unanticipated consequences in some contexts, but you have to read the language as it's written and you have to implement that language.
So last thing I want to ask you about, and we've got maybe a minute or so left here, but these workplace restrictions are a victory for the LGBT community across the country, but it comes just as the Trump administration is also erasing requirements that doctors offer and insurers cover medically appropriate treatment for transgender patients. And Camilla, when we're thinking about the LGBT community here in Illinois especially, is there other legislation that you're keeping an eye on or litigation that you're keeping an eye on that when it comes to LGBTQ rights and protections?
Yes, absolutely. And you're correct. The Trump administration has had the LGBT community in its sights from the very beginning and has passed a series of regulations specifically attacking this community and trying to deprive them of protections in healthcare through not just one, but multiple different regulations. And the most recent one was issued on Friday. That was particularly gratuitous, as everybody knew that the Supreme Court was going to be issuing the Bostock decision very soon. And the Bostock decision essentially concluded that sex discrimination laws should be interpreted to protect people from discrimination based on their gender identity. And the regulation that the Trump administration dropped on Friday says the exact opposite. And of course, the Supreme Court's decision is governing here. The Trump administration cannot issue regulations that violate an interpretation of the law that has been issued by the Supreme Court. So I expect that will be vacated very shortly. But it's an example of just how far this administration is going to try to clear
it. I'm afraid we're gonna have to leave it there. Camilla Taylor is Director of Constitutional Litigation for Lambda Legal. Thank you so much for joining us. More to come after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We are in the midst of a national movement for racial justice, and we've seen college football programs coming under scrutiny. The University of Iowa fired a longtime strength coach, Chris Doyle, following allegations of mistreatment by black student athletes, current and former, or I should say former at least. And just a few days ago, Oklahoma State's coach Mike Gundy was called out by his star running back, Chuba Howard, who is black, after a photo showed the coach wearing a t-shirt from One America Network, which is a far-right news outlet that's spoken out against Black Lives Matter. In a sport where black football players make up nearly half of the rosters, black coaches lead just 9% of programs. But at the University of Illinois, head football coach Lovie Smith has built the most racially diverse coaching staff in a top-tier college football program, at least in sort of the Division I bowl eligible team realm, with 8 black coaches on staff. Our next guest thinks Lovie's program can be a model that helps close the racial disparity in college football. Joining us now is Shannon Ryan, sports reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Hello, Shannon. Thank you for joining us on The 21st.
Thanks for having me on.
And listeners, Illinois football fans, we invite you to join the conversation today with our guest, Shannon Ryan. Call with any questions or comments you might have. The number is 800-222-9455. Again, that number, 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. So, Shannon, how big of an issue? Let's sort of take the big picture here. How big of an issue is racial diversity in college football?
Well, I think it's a pretty big one, especially when you look at it from a historic scope of the way, if you look at the history of football or sports in general and how segregated it was for a long time. And then, we've seen progress through decades and decades of players, that used to be shut out of certain positions. Now, you look at the NFL and you see there are black quarterbacks where that was definitely something that was off limits decades ago, or not even that long ago, that was really uncommon. But when you look at the coaching positions, and it's something that's been talked about so long, year after year, and rules have been put in place at the NFL level, and it doesn't seem to budget all that much. But at the college level, it's just really interesting to see what Lovie Smith at Illinois has kind of quietly done, which is his way, for people who know him, pretty reserved and soft-spoken guy, but he says he's about action, and he wants to give opportunities to young black coaches by putting them in a position so they can move forward through this hierarchy of how hirings usually happen, which is usually you're a position coach, then you move on to a coordinator role, and coordinators become head coaches. But that hasn't been a linear path really for black coaches in the profession. So he's really trying to open up doors by providing these opportunities. And you look at Lovie Smith is just one of 14 African-American coaches out of 130 FBS teams. So, I mean, the numbers are still pretty low there. And, he's hoping that when he's finished with coaching, whenever that would be, that there'll be a change there, and maybe he'll have helped open doors for other coaches.
Yeah, and with more than a half dozen potential, a decade or two down the line, people who are now in the pipeline to be head coach. So you spoke with Lovie Smith at length in your reporting, and you talk about his own journey as a player from Texas to his first opportunity as a coach. Can you walk us through a little bit about how his experience helped shape the program that he's built at Illinois?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. He's a Texas guy from a small town in Texas, and like every kid in Texas is obsessed with the Cowboys. And, but he was telling me how he loved Tom Landry, but he couldn't identify with Tom Landry in some ways. He didn't look like him. And Lovie Smith wanted to be a coach and loved football. And he played football was a coach for almost 25 years before he was ever on a team as a player or coach with a Black head coach. And that's when he joined Tony Dungy's Buccaneer staff in 1996. And Lovie Smith was a linebackers coach then. And that was the only time he's ever experienced that. So, I mean, that's kind of telling in its own right. But if you look at Tony Dungy's coaching tree, I mean, he had a really hard time himself, despite prior success, being extremely qualified Tony Dungy, you know, breaking into getting a head coaching job at the time. And I think, you know, you look at Tony Dungy now, his coaching tree does have, like Lovie Smith has guys who have gone on Black coaches to become head coaches. Herm Edwards, who's now the Arizona State head coach, and he also has brought on a lot of Black assistant coaches onto his staff. But I think that experience of working for Tony Dungy and seeing how he was so committed to providing equal opportunities, giving guys a chance who are often overlooked, that had a huge impact on Lovie Smith and being one of the benefactors of getting a chance like that.
Yeah, and can you talk a little bit more about Tony Dungy and sort of his coaching and hiring philosophy and what, you know, that suggests about giving opportunities for young Black coaches?
Well, yeah, I mean, now he's regarded as one of the best, I think, but you go back and you see he was a guy who, like a lot of Black coaches at the time, just weren't getting the opportunity there. And I think the thing that stands out about it to me, too, I mean, this is kind of the conversation I've had with a lot of people who struggle to see the issue, I think, who have emailed me or talked to me about this. But, you know, you look at the pool of players and who becomes coaches. The pool of players, I mean, right now in FBS football teams, it's almost half of the players are Black. And most of the people who become coaches are former players. So, I mean, it does seem, and this is kind of something Lovie Smith said too, it just seems like common sense that if you're a Black former player, you'd be getting these chances. So, you know, I think a lot of people who want to make the argument of color shouldn't matter and you just hire the most qualified person, but and why make it political? These are kind of the arguments I hear from people, but you know, sports has always been political. It's always kept certain people out or pigeonholed certain people into positions. And I think Tony Dungy had a big role in helping change that. And I think Lovie Smith being around that, seeing other guys get an opportunity. I mean, Lovie Smith said he took a pay cut to join Tony Dungy's staff because he was an assistant at Ohio State. He was actually making more money in college, but went to an NFL team just to have that opportunity to be on a staff and be led by another Black man, a Black coach, was really valuable to him. So, you know, you can kind of see now how that's worked through the way Lovie practices as well.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, this is The 21st. We're speaking with Shannon Ryan, sports reporter at the Chicago Tribune. We invite you to join our conversation. How do you feel about Coach Lovie Smith's successes in building the most racially diverse coaching staff in top-tier football program? Is it as important to you as wins and losses? Give us a call, share your thoughts or any questions you might have for our guest, Shannon Ryan. The number's 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Shannon, so often in sports, success is measured in wins and losses. And by that standard, the Illinois football team has not been at the top of the standings, really, although there has been improvement over the past few seasons. But how much is success in things like building a program of racial inclusion and, you know, positively affecting the lives of student athletes overlooked? And you know, does that ultimately play into a more successful program by, you know, the metric that gets measured on, you know, in the standings?
Well, I mean, this is kind of an issue. I think any coach on any team, regardless of their race, will tell you that it's you have a very short window to win these days. I mean, you see it all the time. I mean, coaches do not get a lot of time to turn a program around. I think that's one of the things that Illinois, they have been really committed to letting Lovie Smith have the time, I think, to try to rebuild it. I think it's important to keep in mind when he took over, the program was at a really, really low point. I mean, just speaking about Illinois specifically for a minute here, is the former coach, there was a lot of accusations about player mistreatment. And there was a lot of scandal about, you know, making players play who were injured. And that coach was fired. So, I mean, the program, they had a ton of turnover at Illinois, athletic directors, coaches. So it was really a program with a ton of turmoil. And I think it was really important for Illinois to exercise, I guess, this patience with Lovie Smith. And they got to back to a bowl game for the first time in like a decade this year. Didn't win, but you see they are showing some improvement. And, you know, that's how everything is measured here. And I don't think Lovie Smith would disagree that they've got to do better, that no matter who you hire, you know, the end of the story here is did you win or lose the game? And that's just how it is in sports. But I think, you know, one of the people I talked to in this story was mentioning about how, you know, really it's just to the idea of diversifying just in any business. It's good for business. I mean, this isn't just a selfless mission for Lovie Smith in some ways, because if you cast a wider net for hiring people, maybe think outside the box, you might get better candidates or candidates who offer something. But I think one of the things a lot of these experts or people in the coaching profession have told me is the reason that one of the reasons that coaching has remained so head coaching has gone to white coaches so much is there's just these recycled names that get rehired and rehired despite a lack of success or, you know, success or not. They're the same names kind of keep coming through. And you see this, I've done stories about this in college basketball too. I think you see it in the NFL, you see it in college football, where there are a lot of cases where you see, and Black coaches will tell you that if you have a rough season and you're fired, you know, the second, third chances aren't there the same way they might be for white coaches. And there is this really pressure. This is something Herm Edwards was telling me in the story is there's just this pressure packed time. I've got to nab the next guy to hire and build this staff so quickly. Everything's so quick in sports and so competitive that sometimes you are going to overlook or you're scared to make the wrong move. Or in college football, so much of it has to do with pleasing donors and pleasing the boosters. And who are those people? Are they going to be happy with the, you know, you having such a diverse staff? And I have to say, you know, I've been pretty pleased with Illinois fans who seem to be, who I've heard from, who are pretty on board with what Lovie Smith's doing there. But it's a pretty complex issue with a lot of history to it.
You know, I want to ask about how this affects the students. You write that racial representation can be profound for athletes of color, particularly in the nation's current climate. And you also report on Illinois running back Levon Bonner, who recently used his platform to speak up against racial injustice. I wonder if you can talk about those ideas.
Yeah, I think that's like one of the something that's been overlooked for a long time. And I think we're finally seeing players have finding a voice and feeling more empowered to use that voice now. And I think you're seeing a lot of teams, I heard you at the beginning mentioning Oklahoma State and Iowa, where players feel they have some leverage now to voice concerns over maybe a lack of empathy or some cultural suppression by all white coaching staffs. Some of the things that happened at Iowa seemed pretty cruel, some of them, and some of them seemed like just these very massive blind spots, you know, rules about what you can wear. And, you know, I think so many college football coaches, it's run in this militaristic style of uniformity and these really strict rules on, you know, what your hair can look like and how you can dress. But I think there's, you see there's a lack of understanding sometimes from a culture aspect when it comes to a coaching staff that is all white, that you're not going to understand those rules maybe don't apply equally to everybody or can be offensive to some people, or you're actually signaling out certain players in a way that maybe you're not even recognizing as a bias of yours. So, I mean, I think that's another aspect of just having a more diverse staff in sports when you are dealing with college players who a roster pretty diverse. I mean, that's one of the things people really, you know, who play sports will tell you. It's a benefit that you're interacting with people that come from all different backgrounds. And that's a real benefit to it. But it's important for the coaching staff to also have that understanding or have different people who might bring something up or say that rule isn't going to go over so well with guys. And I think right now with the protests we're seeing and with athletes being so vocal about racial injustice issues, like Ravon Bonner and this, the Illinois player you mentioned, who has been speaking at rallies. I mean, he said he feels confident. He's not scared to go speak at a rally that his coach is going to get mad. He knows there's coaches who are going to understand why he feels that way. And there's probably a lot of guys on teams who wouldn't feel that comfortable on other teams.
All right. We're going to have to leave our conversation there. Shannon Ryan is a sports reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Shannon, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
And that is all the time we have. Before we go, though, I want to make another pitch for joining our texting group. Send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Our question this week, what unexpected positive realizations or lessons have you discovered during the quarantine? Again, send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. You might hear your response during tomorrow's show. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.